You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, April 15th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
Brooks. Okay, I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time, that's right, 2011, 2012, 2013, and 2014 Podcast Award winner, The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the industrial, well, not in the industrial ravaged Gowanus Canal, but in the surrounding area of the industrial ravaged Gowanus Canal.
Steps from the industrial ravaged.
Steps from, yes.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Samita Mukhopadhyay. She's a leading feminist writer, strategist, and analyst. We're going to be talking about Hillary Clinton's run and the bigger picture. Also, Mindy Kaling's brother, a schmuck. We'll explain why that actually matters.
Yes.
And
joining us today will be Tina Dupuy. Fresh off of her latest appearance, well, as far as I know, on a conservative, weird conservative radio show hosted by some egotistical maniac named The Deuce. I have no idea about that show.
There's an odd similarity between
well,
him
anyway,
and Sam.
Well, anyway, she's going to come on the Majority Report today and talk a little bit about how Republicans are using their presidential runs for pretty much their own advantage, and she has a good comparison as to exactly what it's like. But before we do all that, as we open the show, you might have noticed that we said four-time award-winning, podcast award-winning, The Majority Report. And that's because last night, let me put the camera on me here, being that I'm talking. Give me a second. That's because last night at the Podcast Awards in Las Vegas, Sam Steeder proudly showed up and accepted the award for Best Politics and News Podcast of the Year 2014, making us a four-year straight. 4 years, Michael.
Yep, that's
four
how we do.
4 years straight.
Thank you, everybody.
And I guess there's a little bit of a celebratory song to play.
That's what we are. Thank you so much for making this happen, everybody.
All of our listeners, all of our supporters, whether you listen to the podcast, if you're a member, if you're donated to the Indiegogo campaign, if you're on YouTube, and especially to our good friends over at the Best of the Left podcast.
Yeah, unfortunately, they didn't get a People's Choice, which they should have.
Because they are the People's Choice.
They are the People's Choice. We backed each other up. They came up just short, but of course, they're an amazing show. You should listen to and subscribe to them.
If there's room for only two podcasts in your life, it should be, of course, The Majority Report.
Obviously.
And then the Best of the Left podcast.
All right, but seriously, folks, thank you so, so much. The Majority Militia marches on. We are, with our guerrilla tactics, grassroots insurgency, growing every day, winning our fourth podcast award. Couldn't have done it without you. Thank you so much. We'll be right back with Samita Mukhopadhyay.
Eternal fire, lucky Babylon, you are going to get bruised. We are want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them bruised.
beg you pack up and go. Me said the movement alive. Marcus said fi organize and centralize. Rasta fi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me hear you transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire, lucky Babylon you will go get bruised. Me I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. So we are on them. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I beg your papa one one. Me I tell you, ooh, yeah. Ooh, I tell the papa one one. When them a go with a key and salt fish wing, better them give me a key and garlic. That's right. Pass me a map and a compass on ya. Make me show them say salt fish no come from on ya. That fish they come a far away. They bring him all the way from Norway. Hey, I could rasta them a try fit chicken that kill me. Me national dish a eternal fire. And not even villain you a go get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. Johnny killer want them. Ooh, yeah. I beg your back up and go. Every time you hear about Africa, I shackles and chains. Tell me why you try to corrupt the little Rastaman brain. And if you tell the youth them to Africa exists long before the middle passes. Me come to tell you get to use them for ice. Because Babylon a brainwash the masses a fire. The dirty Babylon you will go get bruised. We are on them fire. I said you just can't win, you're going to lose.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now, Samita Mukhopadhyay. She's a journalist, writer, author of Outdated, and a former executive editor of Feministing. Samita, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? I like that you're one of my only friends that can pronounce my last name.
Really? Well, yeah. Look at that. More cosmopolitan bona fides for Brooksy. I love it. So I really have been wanting to talk to you for a while. And as you mentioned, we are friends and we have these great conversations off air. And sometimes we need to give the world the gift of having them on air. And, you know, when I saw Hillary announce over the weekend, I mean, I certainly have my own feelings about it, which we'll get to. But I thought of you, one of the first people I thought of that I wanted to hear what your sort of big takeaway was on it for two reasons. Because I think you have this broad and very critical perspective, which I think needs to be articulated about Hillary. But you also have, I think a very specific and significant understanding of the importance of her as a woman candidate, what this candidacy means. So let's start broad. What is your main impression here? And then we'll go into different aspects of her candidacy.
So I have to say, sadly, you know, when the announcement dropped, I wanted to be a little bit more kind of overcome by emotion, and I just wasn't. You know,
right.
I think the video felt so much like Josh Lyman had taken over her campaign, right? Like from the West Wing, where she's like, we're going to run a campaign that's about the people, you know?
Right.
Like, you know, it felt so obviously kind of like political maneuvering, and I think that has been one of her struggles is. Kind of a difficulty in expressing her most authentic self
right.
through her political campaigning, and I think that was a problem, in, you know, previously as well. So, you know, I was actually I thought it was interesting that people had these really strong reactions across the internet, and I was like, I am not having these feelings. Like, I don't
right.
feel I'm not like relieved. You know, like I thought that I would be like, oh yes, like let's do this. Like, 42 men, time for a woman, right? And would kind of be overwhelmed by that emotion. And what I'm seeing from a lot of, you know, more kind of complicated thinkers on the topic, is that what's actually pushing them to feel supportive is the retaliation against her, where it's like her campaign hasn't even, like, it's officially started, but, like, we haven't even gotten into full kind of campaign season, and people are just already going after her, and they're criticizing her so much, and it's, you know, and I'm going to feel the same kind of defensiveness that I felt with Obama, where it's like, you know, obviously there are so many policy positions that we can critique about Hillary and her record, but there are also good things that she's done. And I think this kind of overemphasis on attacking her is going to be rooted in sexism, and it's going to be something we have to be extra vigilant about.
Okay, so we'll definitely get to more of that, and I think that is important. But I also think let's actually start by contrasting this announcement with previous announcements that she's had. I think Peter Beinart, I believe, wrote, and I know you're very familiar with the sort of arc of her career. So, and as you've said, one of the difficulties for Hillary has been identifying and putting forward her, you know, quote unquote, authentic self. So when she ran for Senate in New York in 2000, her campaign then emphasized that she was a strong supporter of welfare reform, that she was very hawkish on foreign policy. Obviously, being a senator from New York, she's very close with the financial services industry and Wall Street. That's, you know, obviously not particular to her. That's just part of the nature, unfortunately, of representing New York in Congress. Then when she ran for president in 2007, again, she emphasized hawk on foreign policy, even though she was trying to minimize the damage of her voting for the invasion of Iraq, and you know, still a kind of socially conservative vibe in a certain way. Now, this campaign launch, which I agree with you, I mean, I think Jon Stewart said it looked like a State Farm ad that ran too long or something. It's very easy to make fun of. But obviously with, you know, single women, a gay couple about to get married, you know, those kind of tropes of social conservatism and foreign policy hawkishness were gone. And I guess the question is that, do you think that this is like, okay, so now Hillary feels like she can kind of emerge as more what her actual politics are, or are we just looking at someone who's a very kind of canny political operator, and she sees, okay, social liberalism, that debate is done, the energies with Elizabeth Warren, and I got to get in on that action.
Yeah. So, yeah, I absolutely think, I do think she's, you know, an incredibly, like, kind of smart and savvy political operative, which is, you know, I think she kind of, given the overarching trends in young people being more liberal, being more accepting of same-sex marriage, really wanting, you know, the kind of single woman vote or the, quote, you know, Beyonce voter or whatever, like, she knows to go after exactly that kind of demographic in terms of just overall. I think so much has changed in 15 years. It's crazy to think that 2000 was 15 years ago, but 15 years ago, it wasn't as common for even a progressive, right, to say that they are in, or a Democratic candidate to say they are in support of same-sex marriage, right?
That was basically non-existent, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that is such a new part of the lexicon, but that's also something we're seeing in the most conservative kind of battleground states where same-sex marriage rights are passing, right, on some level. And so I think that she's coming down on exactly the right side of that in the right moment, that, you know, if she didn't come out strong in support of that, like, she would lose young people just completely, right?
Who,
you know,
sure,
and,
of course,
and but,
yeah.
But that said, I still don't know if she's going to kind of rally the type of enthusiasm simply because of her age and because of her kind of experience, and I think people's general distrust with people that have navigated the political system for a long time, right? And so, you know, and I will say, like, I will caveat my lack of enthusiasm balanced with, you know, recognizing that in my lifetime I would have, you know, either a Bush or a Clinton for almost all of the presidents that have been, you know, that I've had, you know, involved in any election. So,
right.
You know, I think that kind of complicates this.
Samita, I need to call you right back. You just totally broke up.
Okay.
All right. Actually, wait. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right. Am I back?
Yeah, you're totally. No, she's not. All right. I should call you right back, Samita.
All right. Cool.
All right. All right, folks. We're back, and I think with a much better line. Okay, so Samita, you were basically talking about how this recognition that within your lifetime you'll basically have in, you know, within any young person's lifetime, Bush. I guess we would be some of us would be born under Reagan or Bush Senior. And then we got, you know, this Obama interlude and, you know, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Clinton. So, yeah, that's quite something to take in.
It is. And, you know, I think just to completely date myself, I was actually during the Carter administration. But
I was trying to cover for you.
But I do think, you know, Rebecca Traister in her article in The New Republic had a really good point about how, you know, Hillary is a little bit from the typical dynasty politics where there's huge percentages of probability between, you know, say a father who works on Wall Street and the likelihood of his son working on Wall Street, right? Or a senator whose son also becomes a senator. But there's actually no zero time that a president's wife has become president, right? So I don't necessarily, like, I don't want to sweep her under the rug as part of the Clinton, quote, in the same sense that I do think that her situation is different because she's a woman and there isn't really a precedent for a woman to become president, right? So for the city for them to go on to become president. So I do think that I want to preserve that for Hillary, at least, right? There is this politics in the family, and I think the enthusiasm around Obama was newer, right? He was newer machine as connected. He wasn't kind of as, you know, ideally entrenched in some of the main considerations of politics. So,
right. But and I think this is an important point though, as we kind of loop up the conversation on Hillary and then we'll get to Mindy Kaling's brother for a second, which is an interesting kind of downgrade and topic of conversation, but also really important. So I think though that this is actually something that came up with Obama as well, in the sense that you said, okay, a lot of the backlash against Hillary, yes, there is going to be a very strongly, there is a misogynist component to it. But there's also plenty of people who really don't like her and really object to her who are kind of salivating for Elizabeth Warren to run for president, even though that's not going to happen. And it's clearly not, you know, that objection is not rooted in misogyny. And there were people who object very strongly to aspect of President Obama's policies, whether it was on, you know, being far too lenient and easy on the banks and Wall Street, or drone policy, or, you know, not being aggressive enough on, you know, any number of things that I guess people with a progressive worldview would want to see implemented or want to see reformed. And this is where we get into this really tricky terrain with these campaigns, in my view, because there is a social and political question and conversation going on that involves dealing with racism, involves dealing with misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are these campaigns and these administrations that, you know, I think in fact with Clinton, in the past, it's been incredibly complex because there's been a lot of sort of running away in some ways from being the first woman candidate in a certain sense. So there was an aspect of that in her 2007-2008 campaign with Obama. There's obviously dealing with race is very complex. But there is this cudgel that you will see among certain people who back Hillary of basically like, don't talk about, you know, her position on TPP. You know, she's a woman. Or don't talk about, you know, backing welfare reform. Do you hold a male candidate to the same standard? And, you know, a lot of people I think are going to answer, first of all, yes, I would. And secondly, like, you know, it's not good enough because we're facing – these really defining crises, whether it's in inequality or climate or anything else or any number of other areas, and they're just not convinced yet that she's really there. And, you know, rightfully, that's a legitimate perspective. So how do we balance all of that, right? Like the legitimate objections with the problematic cultural conversation.
So I missed the end of what you said.
Yeah, basically to reset the question, there's going to be a very strong objection to Hillary from people on these, you know, misogynist, sexist grounds that we're familiar with.
Yeah.
But then there's also going to be a lot of people that are really, really dissatisfied with things as they stand. And from a progressive perspective, they're going to have a number of areas that they can be either disagree with Hillary on, be concerned about her commitment on. And I think that a real question that people are going to have to figure out in this cycle is how do you balance having a frank and real conversation about misogyny and how it applies to her campaign without allowing that to dilute a really rigorous discussion about, you know, frankly, just the really progressive, really sort of strong positions that we need to take if we're going to deal with the crises of 2016, the crises of the future. And I think, you know, editorializing, there's a lot of legitimate reasons to be concerned about where Hillary is on a lot of these defining issues.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think one of the frustrations as political commentators that we have to face is that there's a level of nuance and conversation that needs to happen that is completely overshadowed by these kind of gender-based questions, right? And and I think that can be incredibly frustrating because the symbolism of it then becomes, but like you're either for it, a very simplistic way of looking at it. Whereas, you know, any kind of complicated thinker or, I don't even want to say complicated thinker because that sounds elitist, but it's, you know, if you actually want to look at policy implications, like, are gender only partially important in those conversations, right? Like, it's actually going to matter if, you know, where it falls on, you know, if she continues that she's supported in terms of her policy. Like, there are going to be real world consequences for that for different groups of people, not just for kind of white women or feminists, you know, whatever kind of she hopes to identify with most. And so I think our inability to be able to have that conversation in a complex way is going to continue to be a frustration. And I think a frustration during the Obama election too. Like, I think in time around, you know, they're super frustrated. They didn't feel like change that they thought they were going to see. They didn't feel like he really spoke to a lot of kind of progressive values that really got him into office. You know, and I think that that lack of nuance, my hope is that instead of having another blood battle in public, what she's wearing, we can actually have a conversation about her policy, right? And, you know, and I, you know, I do in some ways blame mainstream media for their continued reliance on the position at a much kind of junior level, right? At a very kind of remedial level, like who she said, as opposed to actually taking policy positions and not just focusing on, you know, gender.
Right. Samita, so unfortunately the connection is just really bad, unfortunately. Before we sign off, give us, and we will have this conversation again soon, or a similar conversation with a better connection, but tell us really briefly, you wrote this piece recently about Mindy Kaling's brother. Mindy Kaling, of course, is the prominent, you know, sitcom star, comedian. I kind of only really know her from The Office. I've actually never seen her show, but I know a lot of people that really love it. I haven't gotten around to it. Her brother is kind of a, if I could do some Yiddish, she's kind of a meshuggah putz. And he did this thing where he pretended to be black. Just explain it to us as best you can. And there's an article that you just wrote about this that we'll link to as well.
So Mindy Kaling's brother, this guy, BJ Chokol, or something. Actually, Mindy changed her name. And I know way too much about Mindy Kaling.
You know, Samita, I'm going to call you back on the other line. I'm sorry. We'll edit this. It's just too choppy.
All right.
Sorry about this, folks. This is by far the worst phone situation I have ever had hosting the show, and we checked it before and everything was fine, and I really, really apologize. I really do.
Hello.
Samita.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Tell us about Mindy Kaling's brother, who is a little schmuck. Go ahead.
Yeah. So Mindy Kaling's brother, BJ, basically decided that he was not able to get into medical school, and he wanted to prove a point that affirmative action gave preferential treatment to less qualified Black and Latino students over Asian students by shaving his head and trimming his eyelashes and trying to pass as Black. He renamed himself JoJo, you know, also a name equated with the best R&B group of all time, Jodeci.
Yes, I know who you're talking about. You know who you're talking to.
And he claims that due to his change in identity, he got an increase in invitations to apply to schools. It's very hard to get kind of clean data because he didn't apply to the same schools both times, once as Vijay, the second as JoJo. And as JoJo, actually applied to 20 different schools and ultimately got into, I think, a local school in Missouri, medical school. So not really speaking to what he claims that affirmative action kind of helped him.
Wait, so his slam dunk affirmative action is BS case resulted in him only getting into one medical school?
Yes.
So he's – wow. He's – you know what, Samit, if I could do a callback, he's not a complicated thinker.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think so, you know, but he does kind of reflect the anti-affirmative action logic, right? Where it's not actually based in numbers, it's based in self-serving kind of selfish goals around, I want to get into college, I couldn't get in. Now, mind you, he has a 3.14 GPA, okay? I was not a good student, but I know that a 3.14 is not enough to get into medical school. Like, I can tell you that right now. My friends who went to medical school of all races had like 3.9. So I think the only conclusion we can draw is that his grades weren't there to get into medical school. And then ultimately he got into UCLA MBA program as Vijay. And, you know, I think our question there is, a 3.14 is even low for an MBA program. So, you know, how do we know affirmative action didn't help him get into MBA school? We don't. So,
affirmative tailing.
Yeah.
Did he have any other insights into the Black American experience as a result of his experiment?
He did, actually. Yeah. So he also found that he got an increase in police harassment. Which was an unintended side effect. So kind of despite...
I love that. He's like, I got harassed by a bunch of cops, but keep your eye on the big picture. I got into one medical school.
Yeah,
what a moron.
Exactly.
Jesus, this is getting me so annoyed. Maybe it's just like the combination of the phone problems earlier and now just thinking about this guy. I'm irritated.
I think that he is exactly like that conservative that I joked about how like my job on earth is to bring people like that down. Not that it's that hard. They're doing it for themselves, right? But it's, you know, I do think that there is a special place in hell for people of color that are trying to throw other people of color under the bus in the name of kind of maintaining white supremacy. Like, you have got to be kidding me. Like, let's not even look at just the lack of humanity to suggest that affirmative action is a terrible thing. Like, one of the few pieces of legislation in this country that even try to, and frankly, has not even effectively, right, leveled the playing field, has not even effectively. Like, we don't even have the kind of numbers of Black and Latino students in Ivy League schools that we need. Like, not even close, right, or the number of qualified students that are kind of deserving of those spots. So not to mention the lack of humanity in opposing something like that, but the complete ignorance of history that, like, why would we even need affirmative action? Like, how is it different for a South Asian student or an Asian American student or a Black or Latino student who has a completely different history, right, trying to apply to school? So, and all the kind of low-income Asian American kids that actually do benefit from affirmative action policies. So, zero time. He fails all the tests.
Yeah, big fail.
Now, he's claiming he did this to show everyone, like it was a big experiment. But, I mean, is that really why? Or just, like, him trying to like, make a you know, lemonade out of lemons, you know. I couldn't do it in medical school, so let me try to pretend this was some big experiment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like some like really cheesy publicity stunt. since the logic doesn't add up. Like, there's no, like, his logic, his experiment doesn't prove what he's trying to prove. Like, that's so, like, every journalist that just looked directly at, like, what he actually did and the conclusions he drew, there was no logical kind of, like, line.
So I'm
right?
seeing, I'm seeing, Samita, I'm seeing a sketch that you and I write where JoJo is getting, like, beaten by the police. He's getting pulled over and profiled, and he's getting – and, like, with each, you know, cell cam, he's, like, you know, he's like, shouting at the camera, like, no, 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 but keep your eyes on the ball here. I got waitlisted at Missouri State Community Teachers Orthodontist School, and if I didn't get the – ow, hold on. All right, hold on, officers. Please stop beating me. It's because I'm black. Yeah, so that's the big takeaway. So even with this sort of like pathetic, you know, half 80s movie, half wannabe Borat experiment, nothing is proved. And of course, now he is a future leader in corporate America. So that's really inspiring.
I mean, his Twitter, but the first thing on his Twitter bio is literally Mindy Kaling's brother. So, yeah. I mean, that pretty much says it all right there.
So he's got, yeah. he's got Kaling action. Okay, Samita. We're going to have you – I'm definitely going to have you on again soon with a better phone connection, but I still think that this helped point us to the bigger picture that we're going to be talking about in this election cycle, and that's how do we balance, you know, being wary and fighting against all the misogyny, but also, you know, being real about who Hillary is and how this campaign turns out and really waiting for an agenda that's actually going to work on the big issues that we have to deal with, which, of course – very much include the rights of women of all colors and income categories. So, Samita Mukhopadhyay, I really appreciate your time. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right,
folks, we are going to take a brief break. Matt is going to come back with Tina Duppy. Tina Dupuy.
Dupuy. This
Tina
isn't
Dupuy.
Some conservative show. We know our guest name.
She is. She's going to explain why she is no longer. No, I'm just kidding. Yes, Matt will be right back with Tina Dupuy, and we will be back in just a moment. Or just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment. Maybe a moment or two.
Oh,
maybe 3 moments. Maybe you need. You want me to do a little Mission Impossible for you, buddy? Maybe 4 moments, maybe 5 moments, maybe 6 moments. Ah! Okay.
Nearly clubs that's better on the backseat of a bike, and all my fears get washed away in this stream of blinking lights. And the concrete strip below seems less like a noose and more like a tight ass bind. So at least I turn again. And it's been such a hard season. It's mixed me for what we all had. Keeps my crowded. But at least we had this fun. And I like to think we're better off for it. And I've never been. Forget things, thank the bad building supplies. And sometimes they'll get things, thank the bad building supplies. And we'll keep on building. And we'll keep on building. We'll be right back.
All right. We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And joining us now, she is an investigative journalist, and she's been on this show a number of times before. She's a friend of the show, Tina Dupuy. Thank you so much for joining us today. I made sure to say Dupuy.
No, thanks, Binder.
There we go.
See, I did it.
You did it too.
Right.
Yep. Well, I know. There's this conservative show that calls you Duppy or something because they don't know what they're doing over there.
Uh huh. Yeah. No, it's a mystery. I mean, who produces that crap?
Yeah,
really?
It's horrible. And the egotistical maniac that like runs the show, the what is he? The Deuce or something? Jeez, that guy.
Right. Exactly. Psychopath.
It's so interesting how similar he is to Sam.
No, I think that guy pays his producers well.
Connect the dots, people.
So, Tina, thank you for coming on the show today. And I wanted to have you on because as more of these Republicans throw their hat into the 2016 race and enter the clown car, we had Ted Cruz call shotgun in the clown car, and he was the first to enter the say he was running for president. And since then, we've had Rand Paul, we've had Marco Rubio, and we're over a year and a half away from this. So I wanted to have you on because you had a piece, a column that you wrote called A New Era of Televangelists. And I thought that was a great way to approach what the majority of these guys are really doing and what they're looking to get out of this. Go into it, please.
Well, I thought that it was completely appropriate for the launch of the GOP's bid for the White House was hosted by the spoils of televangelism, that they met at, that it was Ted Cruz at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University that was founded with the principle of kind of creating an army of evangelicals who could take over the world and whatever that would entail. So I thought that that was the perfect place that Ted Cruz was not in his home state of Texas, that he was in fact at Liberty University with students who were mandated to go and who were really used to being preached at for that to kind of, you know, for the optics of the 2016 GOP the grand old party's bid to take over the White House, I think now and kind of solidified, especially this term, this kind of also ran industrial complex that we have on the right wing. Unfortunately, and much to my chagrin, the liberals and Democrats do not take care of their kind of talking heads on the left. I wish they would, but they really, you can become a very wealthy person,
yes,
just teasing that you want to be president. This kind of started, in my estimate, with Pat Robertson, who kind of, you know, talking about, failing up. He kind of, you know, he became this kind of icon, but he ran for president in 1988 and really was, the die was cast with Newt Gingrich, mm-hmm, who just kind of by teasing that he is going to maybe try to become the next president of the United States has made himself an incredibly wealthy man.
Now what I find interesting is you bring up Pat Robertson. I mean, he, like you said, he really was the original. I mean, he's still out there, basically as,
yes,
one of the main figures of this religious right. I mean, he's the king of religious right media. He has his own network, and I mean, he espouses this stuff, religious right talking points, and it all started from when he announced his run. You bring up another televangelist who in 1986 you said Oral Roberts. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, so this is the kind of formula that televangelists were doing in the 80s. In the 80s was the golden era of televangelism because America had always had preachers, we'd always had snake oil salesmen, but in the 1980s we had for the first time cable television. So they were kind of able to merge this showbiz glitz with, you know, the Christian message and be on television 24 hours a day and be able to fundraise to a national audience instead of a local audience. So they just became a staple of pop culture and of the national dialogue. But famously, Oral Roberts in 1986 said that if he didn't get, if his ministry failed to raise $8 million, the Lord would call him home. Meaning if he didn't get enough money, from the people watching at home, he was going to die and God was going to kill him. And this was so powerful that he raised $9.1 million and then lived another 20 years. So the formula works.
Do you think that, you know, being that the type of people, the personality traits that would allow you to sort of fall into with these televangelists sell? Because, I mean, I know a lot of, I guess you could call them legitimate, you know, regular Christian pastors. A lot of them are not cool with what these televangelists do. You know, true people of faith, they realize mm-hmm. that, you know, these televangelists are basically lining their pockets in the name of the Lord. And do you think, though, that the certain personality trait that's drawn to these televangelists over, you know, just your regular pastor preaching at a church, do you think that's why perhaps the right wing has moved further to this religious right and sort of tries to appeal more and more to them when running for office to try to get their money because they know that these people will fall for it?
Yeah, I think that, they're trying to, evangelicals are obviously very loyal and they're not the voting bloc that they used to be, which is like the first issue. The second issue is that they're able, when you're courting the evangelical vote, you kind of like, you don't have to be tethered to any kind of reality because you can say whatever you want and you can sell this kind of version of the Garden of Eden, right? Because like in the very near past, we were all better and everything was better and all we have to do is get back to there and everyone will be happier, you know, more Christ-like, whatever. And so it's this kind of, it's a very similar message that televangelists use, actual televangelists, where, you know, if you just give your money and support this and support it with your finances and with your heart, then we will all be able to have this kind of revolution and change everything for the better. It's the same tropes that you will hear over and over again with the current GOP crop, I think that Ted Cruz is definitely the best at this, and that's the kind of message that you'll see with just regular TV personalities who are not trying to gain any kind of power in the White House.
I mean, it's interesting because there was a poll that came out today, I believe, that I saw that that basically it polled Democrats and it found that a two to one margin, Democrats feel that America should come first when dealing with what's best for America and Israel. And then it's the complete reverse when it comes to Republicans. They believe Israel should come first. And I mean, we're a country of 83% of this country is Christian. And I mean, mm-hmm. we know these evangelicals, what they believe in terms of why their support of Israel, they supported Israel.
You should probably, for the people who don't know, it's like their pro-Semitism is actually much creepier than they actually say out loud. It has to do with their doomsday prophet,
exactly,
or their doomsday prophecy, where it's not that they, you know, have an affinity for the Jewish people and whatever you could possibly come up with to, you know, be pro-Semitic, like whatever. But what they actually believe is that that if all the Jews return to Israel, then it's the second coming. Is that it?
Yes, exactly. My
personal doomsday, the doomsday cult that I was born in, is a little bit different than modern evangelicals, and sometimes I conflate them. So correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right.
Okay, that's what evangelicals believe, because like the doomsday prophet that my parents followed was a little bit different when it came to the Jews in Israel. But Right. So they're kind of like full, they're supportive of everything because they believe that Netanyahu is basically the king of the Jews, which is, again, another problem with evangelicals just not quite understanding.
Michael says he believes that too, yes, that he is the king of the Jews, yes.
Okay.
No, because I bring that up because, you know this specific group of these evangelicals, they've taken over the Republican Party. I mean, we could only have to look to, you know, to just last election cycle to see, you know, 2020 last presidential election cycle, 2014. But I mean, just look at the last presidential race, how far some of these guys who before would not have got Rick Santorum getting where he got. You know, Newt Gingrich was well far into the race because he had Sheldon Adelson's money. And I mean, this is a world where, you know, before that, these guys would not have been able to get so far. And I mean, the reason they get so far is because the money pours in. And the reason that money pours in is because, like you lay out, they're becoming this era of new televangelists where they're preaching to this group who's basically funding their lifestyle. And whether or not they actually believe they could become president, that's not the point of really their campaign.
Yeah, I mean, they're running to be wealthy figures in the conservative movement. They're running to get higher speaking fees. They're running to sell a book. I mean, they don't, you know, the problem with having actual power is you end up like Barack Obama, who has to, like, you know, actually compromise and talk to both sides and do all the things that Republicans don't want to do. I mean, they want to throw rocks. I mean, look at Congress. They actually have both houses in their power, and they can't even get their own bills passed. I mean, this is not, they don't want to govern. They just want to complain and talk about how great it would be if they were actually in power. Once they get into power, that, you know, I mean, it turns into a disaster like we've seen before. But just to add to your point, and I think that this needs to be a real sticking point and real conversation during this presidential election, is not whitewashing what Jeb Bush, not whitewashing what his family has done to the country, but also not whitewashing what he did to a woman named Terri Schiavo. And that was an evangelical issue, and that was a national issue that just got to just absurd proportions with evangelicals. And you can go and Google these pictures, praying for and crying and having a protest for the life of Terri Schiavo, who'd been in a vegetative state at the time, I believe it was like 15 years. And her husband wanted to abide by her wishes and take her off life support. And of course the family didn't. And so it turned into, an entire, country, or every evangelical in the country decided that they were going to have an opinion on this and err on the side against her wishes and against her husband's wishes. And instead side with the state, interfering in a very private drama. I mean, this was disgusting. And Jeb Bush has not recanted. He continues to say that he made the right decision. But it is chilling and frightening to think that that a governor of any state, let alone a president, should and the president of the United States, actually, I mean, he was more attentive to Terri Schiavo's needs than to any of the victims of Hurricane Katrina. It took him 3 days to actually pay attention to what was going on in New Orleans, while there were more people the most Americans who died in a natural disaster since the advent of the helicopter. And for whatever reason, George Bush got onto Air Force One to go to Washington to save Terri Schiavo when her life had ended effectively 15 years prior. And we need to remember why this happened. And it was because of the evangelical thread of the Republican Party.
I mean, it's interesting to see because, I mean, previously, I mean, like we just talked about, you gave a little bit of a history of, televangelism and, I mean, but then even though in the 80s when, you know, even when it was the golden age for televangelists. But even then, I feel like, you know, except for that specific group, they were sort of like, you know, an outlier in terms of like the mainstream. But now we see with, you know, these politicians, especially on the, you know, specifically on the right, I should say, grabbing this televangelism style and delivery and profile and who they're appealing to, you know, and then you see the media, you know, I mean, I know it's Fox News, but I mean, this plays into it all. You have Bill O'Reilly out there recently. I mean, he's always been like this, but he's really doubling down where he's talking about how Christians and especially Christian white men are being persecuted in this country. And, you know, the persecution complex feeds into this. And it grows, mm-hmm. and it gives the support, and it's weird to see in this era of like the internet, this televangelism style, take even a step up. You know, I thought, you know, when I watch, like, you know, those televangelists on TV, the ones that are still on TV, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you're flipping through channels, you see them on the paid programming or whatever, and it's sort of a joke, you know, but it's weird to see how it's grown to that. To that specific base,
right? The Christians in this country, it's kind of easy for leaders and people like Bill O'Reilly, kind of talking heads, to sell American Christians on the idea of they're being persecuted, even when they're persecuting other groups.
Like you think after so many, you think after kind of think after so many decades of this televangelism, at some point, you know, these people would have gotten. At least a number of them would have seen into the scam, but instead you're seeing it grow. I'm sorry, continue.
No, I think that this is part of the Christian ethos, right? I mean, they're literally worshiping a martyr and someone who was tortured and murdered for standing up against the establishment. So if you are a Christian, you are quite literally someone who identifies with this plight in life, and whether or not it's true, you still, you know, you have a personal relationship, depending on what sect you're in, but a personal relationship with someone who stood to the establishment and was crucified for it. So, I mean, this is part of the sales pitch, right? Where you can we're under attack, and this is what you need to do, because when people are afraid, they're malleable, and they can get them to do whatever they want, even empty their coffers into incredibly rich, wealthy people's. You know, at this, well, for our discussion, super PACs. And that's what you're seeing.
Exactly. I mean, that's really the reason why this should be talked about in terms of, you know, I know like I mentioned up top, the election is far away, but the issue of money in politics and getting it out is something that will really solve so many of these issues and problems with our system. And the fact that these right wingers who for the most part are entering the race for their own personal gain, they have no chance at winning, but they're able to use the system to really hurt the system and the people within that system. And I think, you know, it's just not talked about enough in the terms of how let me rephrase that. It's not being covered enough in terms of the money in politics. That's what I'm trying to say.
You know, the money that goes into elections to be able to have boots on the ground. Like during the Obama campaign, they had a really impressive kind of mobilizing force, even in red states. You know, when we talk about money in politics, or when you're this discussion that we're talking about money in politics, just to be clear, it's not the it's not the money that it takes to run a campaign. It's the money that's in Sarah Palin's super PAC that's never gone to anybody,
exactly.
Any other candidate, but has managed to like go to something that is probably, you know, legal. Where, you know, because now everything is. I mean, you know, I think that was the best thing that Stephen Colbert did was show us how to make a super PAC and just put another piece of paper onto a regular pack, and then you have a super pack, and you kind of can do whatever you want with it. You know, what's amazing is not what is illegal that's happening, it's what is legal.
Exactly, yes.
That is happening, and how that is so unethical and so immoral and should not be legal, but totally is, and we just kind of have come to accept it.
Tina Dupuy. Follow her on Twitter at Tina Dupuy. Her website, TinaDupuy.com. That's D-U-P-U-Y. You like that, Tina? Thank you.
I like that.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
And I look
Thank
forward.
Thank you, Queens.
Like, I look forward to figuring out how to make this career transition.
Yes. Oh, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Sounds I know. We've done everything wrong with our lives, really.
Well, there's still time, Tina. We can brainstorm this. Okay.
Thanks, guys.
All right, folks. Thank you, Tina. All right, so we're going to go to the second half. Before we do, let's play Sam's it's minimized. Just hover over, you'll find it. All right.
Found.
All right, let's play. It's on my computer. It's all right, let's play. So last night, Sam Cedar was at the Podcast Awards and accepted the award. Four times, it's 4 years straight now we've won. Best Politics and News. He accepted the award for 2014. Let's play that acceptance.
Politics and News.
Politics and News.
Okay, wow. They cover a wide range of categories going on in our world. These are very important podcasts to listen to.
The hosts are...
They are, but we should stay neutral because you never talk about politics
or
religion.
And
we love all parties.
Yeah.
Democratic Party.
Right, Republicans.
Libertarian.
Right, the whole thing. The rent is too damn high, you know. That
the green face
guy.
Category.
Yeah, exactly.
People sitting at tables at podcast award shows.
People
party.
Who hate cats.
Is that a party?
No, but there's a lot of
They'll
people
who hate
win. Cats.
Like, Those guys will never win. They'll never have a chance.
That's true.
All right, the nominees are...
Majority Report. No Agenda with Adam Curry. Common Sense. Congressional Dish. Bob and Chez Show. Slate Political Gabfest. Best of the Left. Cognitive Dissonance. Democracy Now. The Rachel Maddow Show.
And the award goes to Majority Report.
The guy's coming.
Yay!
Wow!
You run, you go, you won it!
I want to thank the guy for the hat for not doing a political podcast. So thank you. I also want to thank my producers, Matt, Michael. Michael's probably at a wine bar right now, pre-celebrating. Matt's at home, I know, hopefully ripping this off of the YouTube, and we're going to post it in a day or two. I want to thank Kyle, who made this show possible. And of course, I want to thank our audience. This is the fourth one we've won, and they give me the opportunity to talk about some really arcane Supreme Court cases and interview people about Medicare policy and make fun of right-wingers. thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Congratulations.
All right, man.
Congratulations.
It's funny, he said that he won four podcasts.
Four podcast awards.
Whoopty frickin' do.
I know, I've won,
I've won zero.
Zero.
Yeah, I've won four podcasts.
Oh, man, I wish I could have had Chris Jericho make fun of me. No, but yeah. So, in case you're wondering,
is that who that guy is?
Yeah, apparently, this guy wearing some crazy like bucket hat type deal, he has a bunch of podcasts with his network, and they basically sweep the show almost, winning almost every award in whatever category they were in. So that's what Sam mentioned by thanks to the hat guy for not making a political podcast. So yeah, we're gonna go to the better half. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I am us through the app, majorityapp.com. That's where you could go to download it. Buy all your junk through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Our Indiegogo campaign is still going. We're well past our goal, but if you still want to donate, we got great perks up that you could still get. And I think Sam's still going to put up one more, the old Marin Cedar stuff, which... you can't get anywhere else. That should be good when he puts it up. And justcoffee.coop, use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off free trade coffee and chocolates. Sam Cedar will be live in Vegas at the conference Thursday and Friday. That's tomorrow and the day after. Show will be as normal. You go to majority.fm and you click live when the button shows up. If it's a live show, he's going to be live at the conference in Vegas. We will see you tomorrow. And members, we will see you in a few minutes in the fun half.